Welcome to Byte Action Podcast. For those who don't know, Byte Action Podcast is on a mission to bring you raw and filtered journeys of experienced and influential people in video games and creative tech industries. If you want to understand how games are made, who are the creators behind your everyday entertainment, and what it takes to build successful companies, games, and products, then you should give this a listen.
Maybe if you have time today, we can do that as well.
Yeah.
I'm more curious, like, now that I, like, got it all off my chest, what do you want to talk about, actually?
I mean, I've got some questions prepared.
Sure.
So I have some stuff here. So I definitely want to talk about your game.
Which one?
Your board game.
Aw, thank you.
Yeah, so, and I actually, like, got a copy of it, and I'm waiting, you know.
Seriously?
Yeah, yeah.
One like, of my backers?
Yeah, one of your backers, yeah.
Fuck.
Yeah.
That's so cool. Oh, my God. Yeah, I just posted an update today because, yeah. Like, things are moving, but...
Can you maybe sit closer to the...
Of course.
So we record properly.
But that's amazing.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Thank you for being there.
No, I mean, when I saw it, I was like, well, this is cool. I'm going to definitely back it up. Because I play board games at home, like with my wife and when friends come over and stuff. Yeah. So this is something new. I mean, I don't really understand it yet.
It's actually...
Maybe you can explain it. So I thought I'd have you here to come and explain it as well.
Yeah.
How it works.
I can do that.
Yeah.
Are you recording now?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, cool. No, it's actually quite simple. Like, to give you a little bit of context where it was coming from, like... As everyone during the pandemic, I was finding myself with more time than I had previously available.
Mm-hmm.
And I always wanted to make a board game. Like, I'm a huge board game aficionado. I have, like, I think right now over 300 at home. Just, it sounds like a lot, but if you think of small box games, it's not that much.
I remember that. I think we spoke in the past.
I think when we were talking in the past on a video call,
my wall of board games. I saw your wall of board games.
And that is...
Did you manage to transport them all here?
Yes. That was the most majority of my container that I was bringing from London over to Barcelona. And I always justified it with, to myself and everyone that has ever seen that wall. It's like, first of all, it's not that much. I know people that have more, especially people who work in board games and like publish board games. And it is also reference material, like definitely. Like I had so many times just recently, now that we started the manufacturing process, where I grabbed small boxes because I'm looking into a small box game, or Nujum will be a small box game. And I checked like, how do they do barcodes? Like what kind of text do they have in the back, like on the back of their boxes? How do they design the size of the boxes? Like it's really, really helpful to have that kind of reference material. And it's always better to have the box in your hand because something that is you don't get in digital as much as an analog is a physical product. And physical products in digital are vanishing even more. Like now that we have like a lot of different online stores like Steam, Epic Game Store, and so on. So you have less and less physical products. But for board games, the physical experience, the analog experience is very, very different. Because it's a journey that you're designing. Like when you get your board game, as one of my backers, you will get one. But when you get your board game, you will find a box that is hopefully in like foiled up and everything. And you will feel the paper, you will feel the box, which will have like a certain quality and certain imprints and stuff like that. The light will hopefully break on the foil printing on the cover of the box. And then you will open it. And then everything from that moment where you hold the box and where you open it is also designed on. I want you to feel like you're like holding a luxury product in hand, and that you're getting excited the moment you open it. And you're like, oh my God, this is going to be a journey, something that I will enjoy with my friends, with my family. And you don't have that. Like that's, you could call the first time user experience kind of in video games, but the tactility of it is very, very different and is definitely something that I enjoyed over the course of making that board game. You're touching different papers, different cardboard materials. Yeah. Nujum will have a cloth board. So that is also designed. Like I wanted to have something that is not just paper. I wanted to give you a nice feeling if you're moving a token over something that feels like a carpet. Because it's heavily inspired by the Islamic Golden Age. And I wanted to bring in fabric as another material that elevates that.
Okay.
So... That's a lot of thought that usually you don't get when you like just saw the Kickstarter
page. I mean, when I saw it, like the first thing that kind of makes you say, wow, is the design. Like, it's really well designed. I mean, you know, the whole box is, I don't know, obviously it's going to be even more, like, you're going to even be even more in awe when you saw it and when you see it in person, I'm sure. I don't know if you saw it in person. I don't know if it's printed already.
I have some prototypes that I use for reviewers, but they are not the final manufactured one. They are very, very different from what I imagine, envisioned the final product to be.
But yeah, I mean, like, the designs look really cool.
Thank you. So I cannot take credit for that.
Yeah.
For that's a lot of the art. Most of the majority of the art is done by Alba Ballesta Gonzalez, mm-hmm. who has become one of my best friends over the course of this project.
Is she from here?
She's from Andalusia. And funny enough, I found her in ArtStation because the whole process of making a board game, this took me from the initial idea to bring it to Kickstarter 4 years. And despite having a lot of time at hand during the pandemic, but I explain it to also everyone that asked me, like, how do I do a board game? Like, what do I have to consider? Mm-hmm. And it's just not like having a good idea. Like, I'm full-time producer, so I wanted to keep it small in scope because I already knew the larger the scope, the more it will cost the people to pay, like, that want it. Also for prototyping, also like just balancing and testing will take forever. So it's actually quite simple.
Yeah. You don't want to make a monopoly. Something. Yeah.
I should have brought it today. But that's the thing. I wanted a game that I could play with my mother. That was the initial idea. Or with my partner. Something that you can just pull out of your bag real quick. You can explain in 5 minutes and just enjoy while having a chat. That was the initial idea behind Ujum. Like, having something that you can bring to a cafe and that doesn't interrupt the flow of conversation, but actually encourages you to connect with someone on the other side.
Well, where's the name coming from?
That's Arabic. Actually, it works in most Arabic languages. It's just stars. It means stars. And I was like, because I'm white and male, I wanted to make sure that I don't do mistakes in that regard. Like, I had a lot of consultancy by friends that have like different Arabic backgrounds that are Muslim. And I was asking them, like, what do you think about the name? What do you think about the depiction that I'm using and stuff like that? And I got greenlit by all of them. I said, like, Nujum is just a very beautiful word in Arabic. And that's why it's also written in Arabic, and it will, on the box, that name in Arabic will be the only one that has gold imprint. And it's not just because I wanted to make it feel luxurious, mm-hmm. but I also, and that's a little bit of my personal agenda, I wanted to make something that is, let me rephrase that. The Arabic language is very negatively connotated, unfortunately. It's such a beautiful language, but if you see it written, a lot of negative emotions in the West come up, which is a shame because the calligraphy of Arabic language and the Arabic language itself is very, very beautiful. And I wanted to create a product that carries an Arabic name and Arabic calligraphy and that feels luxurious and kind of has a disconnect between these negative emotions many people have with a language, but at the same time feels like something beautiful that you want to show off, that you want to bring to your friends. And yeah, having your shelf in a prominent space that makes people wonder, oh my God, what is this? This looks amazing. And you can say...
Yeah, it's something you want to put on the shelf. And it's something different as well. Like, that's what I like about Kickstarter as well. And sometimes I even go there and just kind of look for unusual products, unusual things to buy. Sometimes it can get a little bit tricky because not all of them come to fruition. But it's cool to discover some... Like unusual
things. That is actually where a lot of the last 2 years went into as well. Like I'm a first time creator on Kickstarter. It's also my first board game. So I wanted to make sure that it is a success. I never wanted to make money with this. And I think that's a lot of first time creators or people that design board games have that assumption that they will get rich. They will make the next Gloomhaven or something like that. And that's the trap. Is one in a million. It's very unlikely that your board game will like hit the shelves and like in Walmart and everywhere because it was a massive success on Kickstarter. Usually you can be happy, especially because Kickstarter is very crowded with board games nowadays and like GameFound came around as well. And BakerKit is looking also building their own crowdfunding platform for board games. There's a lot of board games and the last 2 years, just to finish that thought, have been me networking, marketing, making sure that people know that this game was coming, creating a tabletop simulator mod, going to playtesting, going to board game fairs, making sure that people know about it. And that eventually is what brought me over the finishing line, barely.
How did you market it? Was it social media? Was it going to fairs or like what?
Building a community. I knew my target audience that I defined, like also over the course of the development of this game. I knew who I wanted to that game to appeal to, and I knew that the majority of my audience would be on Instagram. So I focused a lot of my private funds into marketing on Instagram. Like I think I made a card, like I made an Instagram post for every card where I was highlighting the fidelity of the art and like always connecting it with my brand, because Purple Plant Games is very simple why it's named that. Like purple is my favorite color. I love plants. So it was like, there you go. And I always connected the Instagram post with plants and the beautiful art and just built a brand. That was something I did also over the course of the last 2 years, where I was heavily focusing on marketing. And yeah, mainly Instagram, mainly the Meta universe, like ecosystem, and a little bit of like just self-advertisement on big platforms like Board Game Geeks, like similar. Like I went also to Spiel in Essen, like talk with designers there, just connecting with other designers, started being very active in online communities for board game designers, like always coming from a place of generosity, of course. And that is something sure. I always can recommend to everyone in every situation. If you want to network, don't approach people like you want something from them. Approach them like you have something for them. And it will always put you in a better mindset and always in a better spot when you're trying to connect with other people. What can I do for you? Not what can you do for me? Is very, very important. And there are a lot of board game designers. And you realize that when you are like 4 years into your journey, where you're like, oh my God, I actually know things. And that helps quite a lot. It helps quite a lot to share that knowledge for people that mm-hmm. with people that are at the beginning of their journey, at the beginning of their potentially 4 years. You're like, okay, look at this and this. Keep this in mind. By the way, you need these box markings. Otherwise, you will have trouble putting that into stores. Like simple things like that.
Do you think about what would you have done differently? Or is there anything that you would have done differently?
I don't think I would have done anything differently, which is funny. Because now in retrospect, I had a successful Kickstarter. Like I said, I managed my own expectations. I always knew I will make a bearable, like my best case scenario was, I'm going to make a bearable minus. But then I asked myself the question, like, why do I make this game? I want to make this game because I want to make this game, not because I want to make money. I want to create something that is potentially of cultural value and brings joy to people. That was my goal. I was like, for that, I need money. So this is the minimum amount of money that I need to make this experience for people.
Sure.
And deliver towards that. I don't think I would have done anything different because like I said, my main job is being a producer. So mm-hmm. I always manage my expectations and my scope.
How long is the campaign on Kickstarter? Like from the moment you start raising the funds, like how long does Kickstarter give you? Or is it depend on you?
You can completely decide how long this campaign goes, but there are right. best practices. I was also very fortunate to have someone at Kickstarter that I got to know, Nicole, who was also amazing. She's taking care of the games on the Kickstarter side, and she was giving me a lot of valuable advice as a first time creator and like traps that you could fall into, like what's a good day to start the campaign, like who to approach to get support for like text and videos and stuff like that. She has been just plain up amazing, and I think that's also helped me to get the campaign over the finishing line. And her support was it also eventually that got me the tech of like staff pick, like mm-hmm. and that was another tech, because she highly encouraged me to launch it in a certain window, because it was a campaign for Halloween, like kind of witchy stuff and stuff like that. And she was like, perfect fit, you want to start in that month. And so I did. But you can go with your campaign for 2 months, 3 months, but the sweet spot is around 20, 25 days. So yeah. that's what I went for. I went for 21 days, as far as I remember, 21 or 23, one of the two, like roughly 3 weeks. Because that's usually like I didn't have the budget and also not the time to invest more, like of myself, mm-hmm. basically. Because running a campaign for 3 weeks means basically that you as a person, as the community manager as well as a designer, are answering comments, emails, like questions
everything.
For 3 weeks straight, because this is a global campaign. Everyone can back. So some people wake up doing wake up in the morning in the US and ask you a question, and that is like somewhere in the night for you, and you're like, oh my god, this person needs their answers. it's not that insane, but like it keeps you on your toes.
What do people ask? I mean,
there were actually some very good questions. Like I was very, some of them expected, and I had already a FAQ for that, so I could point them towards that. One of the most asked question was like, why do you not deliver to my country? And it's like,
okay.
Ah, yeah, I know this is rough, but I only chose a certain amount of countries, because I knew I could, if worse comes to worse and I have to get the packages to my home, I would feel comfortable like managing these countries to deliver to with the customs and everything.
Right. So you're going to be delivering it yourself?
Is no. But just if worse comes to worse, I would feel comfortable with that. And that's again, I think this is just producer mindset. Like, what are the different scenarios? How could it like turn out?
Yeah.
And like, if I don't find a good delivery, like logistics partner in time, like, then I have to do it myself. Can I do it myself? Yes, I can do that. Then obviously the geopolitical things were also like a factor in that. I had a guy from Israel asking me if he could get a copy, because I was also not listing Israel, because I was quite worried on how the political situation would develop. That was in October, right? So it was just, the war was just starting. And yeah, I just wanted to make sure that my games could also be delivered. But he was so cute. And I told him, look, I will personally send a copy to you. You don't have to pay anything right now. I will make sure you get the signed one. Just be safe. And we'll take it from there. And if it's just one copy for one person that is in the war zone right now, then okay.
Sure.
But like, I'm very happy that the campaign was not too successful. Let me put it that way, because then I would have had trouble with these kind of questions. Another question was really, it was also related towards the cultural aspects of the game. Like, I really liked that question because it gave me the opportunity to basically drop everything that I had in my head for so long. Like, but are you actually okay with like depicting people like, and like, because in Islam this is a problem, you don't depict certain things with people. And yes, that's true. And I mean, I did my homework, but I was like, this, it's inspired by, it's not literally a depiction of. And that was always very important for me, because I want to be very respectful with the religions that I take inspiration from. That's why I was also consulting a lot of people to make sure that this is adequate and that's no hurting no one's feelings. And the Islamic Golden Age, while it carries the name of Islam, is way more than just religion. It's a beautiful time period where people were just in constant exchange with each other. Sorry. Mm-hmm. Where people had conversations and dialogue, like medicine, like about medicine, philosophy, religion, everything in the Middle East, and where it was a huge hub for a lot of things that we are still profiting from in modern days, because people had open dialogue without any prejudice towards their like trait or like their preferences. So I really found myself inspired by that. And I wanted Nujum to be a game that encourages dialogue. And that's where the name, where the idea came from, and where the inspiration comes from.
And the Islamic Golden Age for you, is it something that you've been interested in for a very long time, or you just kind of came across it and that's what inspired you to make the game? And
it was an interesting process. Nujum itself was inspired by a game mechanic of a video game.
Okay.
And I was like, I really like that tug of war mechanic, but usually then I checked out of the board games. It was like, oh, tug of war and board games is usually you have your own bars, but you never share one. And I was like, wouldn't it be interesting if you work on the same? So I developed that idea just with a paper prototype. And eventually I was like, okay, I don't want to get too invested into that before I have a theme. So what moves back and forth like forever? And I was like, I mean, sun and moon, day and night is something that's continuously ongoing. I wonder if I can find something that is like, can carry the mechanic, or otherwise the mechanic carrying the game. Like, it has to be a symbiotic relationship. And then I started researching, and I was a couple of months just like trying to find something that was resonating with me, that sparked joy. And I found a very good book, and also a very interesting paper about the Islamic Golden Age, and I was like, that's it. Like that's the in essence what I want to do with this game.
Nice. So it sort of came to you.
It just kind of came to me. Yeah. It felt natural, and from that point on, I could just everything was falling in place like Tetris blocks. Like Sun and Moon made sense. Like the depiction of like actually something very interesting. The depiction is actually different from most like mythological depictions of Sun and Moon on our planet at least. Mm-hmm. And that's usually the way the sun is depicted in almost every mythology on this planet is male and the woman is the moon. And I was like, what? And I was talking with my artist, like, what if we turn that around? And she was like, that's brilliant. Let's do it. And it turned out so well. And it gives it also some sort of uniqueness. Mm-hmm. We felt like, yeah, like, why not? And it just felt natural. So I don't know. Yeah. All the thing just came together organically.
And what do you do in the game, actually? Like, what's the goal? And how do you play it?
I mean, that's a fair question. Now that I've told about packaging all the time. it's actually quite simple. You and your opponent or like, mm-hmm. like you get five cards, Nujum cards. Nujum cards have one of two suits, sun or moon. And they have a number from 1 to 6. You have a board in the center, or like the fabric board that has in total 7 spaces. The center space is empty. And then to the left, you have 3 sun spaces. And to the right, you have 3 moon spaces. Okay. And what you do in your turn is you put down a card in front of you, face down. And then your opponent will put a card on top of yours. And then you resolve in that order. That means you have to guess what kind of suit and what kind of number your opponent is putting on your card, because it will resolve first. Resolving means you take the token and you move that amount of spaces towards the sun or moon side. If the token cannot move the full amount of spaces, it remains where it is and you lose that card. So you don't score it. So it's a little bit of like bluffing and also like understanding your opponent, like what kind of mind game will your opponent play in your turn to ruin the points that you will reveal second.
Right.
So that's the big twist. It's like the twist is you go second in your own turn, and it requires only like 1 or 2 turns before it clicks. But then it's a lot of fun because then the bluffing game starts. And funny enough, I'm very bad at my own game, and I constantly get beaten, and it's always very tight. So I'm also quite happy with the balancing. But I saw strategies develop during the playtesting, where I was like, I was not even aware you could do that. But I was like, that's so great. Like, you bet me in my own game with something that is actually part of the rules, but I was never thinking of.
Yeah.
And that made it even more fun for me. Because I didn't want it to feel too RNG, like too random, because you have random 5 cards and stuff like that. I introduced later in the process of developing the game, the Eclipse cards, which you also get one and your opponent gets one at the beginning of the game that allow you to alter the movement of the stars. So you like there are cards like, oh, and there are 5 of them can be like there are 5 of them. Mm-hmm. 4 of them are played passively. So you can only change your card. And the 5th one can be played on your card or your opponent's card. For me, that was very important because I wanted a game that is not like take that. I'm ruining your turn. It's like, no, I can save my turn with a card, with an Eclipse card, rather than ruining your like the fun for you. I really don't like these kind of games. So I want, you can, like I said, the 5th card can be played on your opponent's card. So you can decide to be a prick.
Yeah.
But then it's a decision. It's not because the game asked you to. You could use this card also defensively. But that's just to eradicate a little bit the fact that, yeah, you get a random numbers on your hand, and I wanted to feel you're more in power of the situation. Mm-hmm. And every time you end in the centerpiece, empty one, in your turn, you get a new one. So there's also a way on how to like that to encourage you to play the token in a certain direction so you get into the center, because these cards are quite powerful.
Okay. And you play one-on-one.
You don't play. Yeah. Right. And I mentioned it before. I think I mentioned in the beginning, like I wanted to encourage conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And it works very well. Like I've played this game in a pub. I've played this game in a cafe. People played it in their lunch breaks and like when I brought it to the office. And what made me very happy every time I saw it was how people were just talking about the weather, their job and stuff like that while playing. I was like, that's exactly what I wanted. It's the nice. Game is not in focus. The conversation is in focus, but you do something that is like that you can do by the by while having that conversation, and kind of you have a reason to talk. That's basically what the game is there for. It gives you an opportunity to have a conversation.
Nice. I like that. Do you have a release date yet? When is that coming out?
So
it's like with the game in the games industry, you know?
Yeah,
you we're not allowed to say.
No, I can. I mean, my goal, like, I stick to what I said on my Kickstarter campaign. Like, it will be delivered in November.
Okay.
But here's the thing, that's the latest. I'm not just a creator on Kickstarter, I'm a heavy consumer and like part of the community on Kickstarter. I think I have backed over 100 projects at this point. And I really love that platform and the idea behind it. And a lot of times people are not conservative enough with their estimates about when a game can be delivered.
Yeah.
And most of my Kickstarter projects that I back get delivered late. Most of them, in all fairness, because some are really good with estimating and they deliver in time. I wanted to be very conservative. So and don't quote me on that yet. Because things can happen. No one saw COVID coming. And I don't want to know what might happen this year. 2024 has been a mental year so far. I want to deliver in November 2024. And I want to make sure that it is to the quality that I want it to be. And so I have a high standard for that. My manufacturer is way more optimistic than me. They're like, yeah, that's going to ship mid of this year. Mm-hmm. I'm like, yeah, we'll cross the bridge when we get there. Yeah. If like no one will complain if they get their game earlier, everyone will be very upset if they get their game later than the estimated date. So I'm carefully optimistic that it will be before November, but I don't want to nail down a date besides November.
What do you normally back on Kickstarter? Is it other board games?
Yeah, pretty much. Like board games and tabletop RPGs quite a lot these days. Okay. That is actually something that I'm looking heavily into right now. It's a slight teaser for you. I only talked with Kickstarter about that so far. I've been starting like research for my next board game roughly a year ago. And it's going to be heavily inspired by tabletop RPGs.
Okay.
Because I want to bring you a tabletop RPG experience that you can play with your friends in an hour with a lot of replayability value and a theme that is like universal, but can also feel personal and that doesn't require a game master. And that's all I can say at this point.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Very intriguing.
So yeah, like I pitch it to Kickstarter. They seem very excited about the idea and like supported me for that as well. And I mentioned it as part of my Kickstarter campaign for Nojum. Like, funny enough, none of the money that is being like got into that campaign is for me. like most of it will go to the manufacturer and the logistics, and the rest will go straight to the artists for the next game because art is expensive. And for Nojum, I paid it all out of my own pocket, and I will still have to pay quite a bit out of my own pocket for the next game, but it will definitely help me to decrease the risk for me financially to have a little bit of funding up front. And I think that the kind of like deluxe version, not deluxe version, like the signed copy was basically you were buying like a free copy, like two copies, but you only get one. And that money is going straight to the art. Like, so I can make sure that the next game looks even better.
Nice. Well, I'm very curious to see. I mean, judging by this one and how this one looks like, I'm like very curious to see how the next one.
Like, there are like so many talented artists, and I like have already a wish list accumulated for those I want to work with. And I spoke with Alba, my artist on Zoom recently about that as well. And I told her, I want you to do the art direction for the next one. And she basically already said yes. So yeah, I'm pretty sure it will look great. I just hope I can make it also play great. That's on me. And
nice.
Especially with that kind of like with the TTRPGs in mind that are like exciting so many people nowadays, I want to be respectful with that material as well. And the theme and the genre.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to make sure it lands on its feet and that people are actually enjoying it.
What's your favorite board game?
Oh, that's tricky.
Maybe name like your top three.
I can always name one that I will always bring to the table. If you would come to my house and you're like, I want to play something mid-core, that a game that you really enjoy, Daniel, I would say Scythe by Jamie Stegmaier and Stonemaier Games. It was my entry to the modern board gaming hobby, because I was working still in Berlin at that point, and a friend of mine was like, I want to play a board game tonight. Like, we gather some friends, like, pop some beers. It's like, board games, I don't know, Monopoly, Risk, and Catan, I'm good. They were like, nothing of that. And I was like, okay, what are you playing? Scythe. And I was like, I never heard that game before. And we were playing it, and I was blown away. I was like, this is board games? I mean, that was already like 10 years ago, like where the golden era of board games was quasi emerging. And I immediately went out to buy my own copy, and I can recite the rules like by memory, because it plays a very important role for me. And like, I would always bring it to the table if people are curious about what modern board gaming is. And like, this is what modern board gaming is. It might not be the best example, but it's my favorite example.
Yeah,
if you haven't played it, you should definitely do that.
I haven't. This is definitely a good one. I'll definitely try it out. Let's jump into your kind of story in addition to your kind of board game career. So you're a producer. Tell me how you started. Like, what brought you to video games in general? Like, what's your journey like?
It's funny because like a lot of the very good producers I know have some weird background. And I'm no different. I wouldn't say I'm a good producer. I would just say I have a weird background. I initially started working as a butcher. Like I worked 9 years in a slaughterhouse, like next to my father, who at some point was like, do you want to earn some pocket money? And I was like, sure. And I was like, all right.
You were still at school.
Yeah, I was still at school. And I was like, all right, let's go have a night shift. I think it's illegal. I didn't complain. It was very good money for a teenager. And I also like followed up on that while I was starting my studies. Mm-hmm. I studied to be a teacher for like high school as a teacher for Catholic religion and physics. And people usually say that's a weird, very weird combination. It's like, yeah, but in Germany, you have to have two classes if you want to be a teacher. Physics is really, really hard. And religion... No disrespect here, but religion is very, very easy. So I took those just to compensate for the fact that I had to put a lot of time and effort into physics. And I also knew that I could have basically chosen a school wherever I wanted to go, because this combination was so rare that I could have basically picked whatever. I didn't want to be a teacher at some point anymore. It's like, this is not very rewarding. And yeah, I also kind of got disillusioned by the fact that I would always be a teacher. It was like, do I want to live my life as a teacher? And the answer was no. I just had a point of self-reflection. And my father was like, you're good with computers, do something with computers. And I was like, all right, I'm going to do something with computers then. And I followed up with an apprenticeship as an IT specialist. That's how it's called in Germany, which means you can do everything a little bit, but nothing really good.
Yeah.
So I learned to code. I learned to basically clip cables. I was doing server administration. I was doing everything. And after 3 years of apprenticeship, my boss was like, so what do you want to do, Daniel? And I was like, actually, no one ever asked me. So I was like, I don't even know. And she was like, you're good with words. How about project management? And I was like, not aware of that option at all. Like, I was thinking about more going towards the coding side of things. And I was like, sure, why not? So I became a project manager in telecommunications,
mm-hmm.
back then for Vodafone in Germany. I had a lot of fun. I learned the ropes. I had a really good mentor. Then went from project management and telecommunication into consulting for project management, because I wanted to see the world. I didn't see the world. I got immediately sold back to Vodafone, because consultants are just mercenaries. And that experience was way too valuable for my employer to not let me go back to Vodafone. Yeah. And at some point I was like, okay, that cannot be it. Can I combine maybe being good with words and being good with project management with games somehow? Because I was always a very passionate gamer. And then I did some job coaching and like did some introspective. I was like, okay, what do I really want to do from life? What do I want to see? I had one of these moments. What do I want to see when I look into the mirror, opening my last toothpaste? And I'm like, okay, this was worth it. And I had a very, very, very cheesy thought that I carry as a mantra to this date. And it's like, I want to make as many happy people happy as possible. was like, how can I do that? It's deliberately abstract. And I would recommend to everyone who's like struggling to ask, like look inside yourself as well. It's like, what do you live for? What's the abstract goal that you have for yourself? And that can be everything. Just keep it abstract so it's actually achievable. I was like, I could be a baker. I could make cupcakes and I would make a lot of people happy. But I also can make video games or board games. I will make a lot of people happy. A lot, deliberately also abstract. And so I combined that with my project management skills and I was like, okay, let me see if I can get into games. And I got an opportunity in Berlin at Exocet at that point, who were like super, super nice to me, like gave me the opportunity to grow also in that role.
Was that mobile games?
That was games on demand, kind of, games as a service. So people were coming to us. We were an agency and they were like, I want to make a game.
Okay.
This is my idea. Here's my money. And we're like, okay, we're going to make your game.
Okay.
Eventually we ended up though with like some big board game brands. Like I had the opportunity to take over the games department and define our strategy. And you can see there, the hobbies already like also coming, like getting there. We were working on Catan, the board game, as a video game for different platforms. And that was a lot of fun. And we also were working on Carcassonne. And I basically defined with my team the strategy for us. We positioned ourselves as a solution for people that wanted to digitalize their board games. So we got Blood Rage as well, which is what one of the cool Mini or Not games from Eric Lang, from the Eric Lang trilogy. And I don't think I can talk about that. I think that's still under NDA. But there are more board games that were made like after I left. I left mostly because of work-life balance reasons. I was like, it was just too much to juggle. And I didn't get as much support as I would have needed. So I moved on to mobile. Had a really good time at VUGA in Berlin. As a content producer for a game called Tropicats, and super lovely game. Unfortunately, didn't make enough money. But that's mobile and match three for you. Like match three is a very, very cutthroat market. And we just didn't have the marketing budget, like a King or a similar, to compete properly with them.
Right.
So after that got put into maintenance mode, I was considering, okay, what would be my next step? And I went to Bossa in London, which is a indie game studio. I was there for the release of Surgeon Simulator 2, then got I Am Fish as a lead producer, which is a game I'm very, very proud of. And then was there until the start of the production of, from the early game jam to the start of production of Lost Skies, which is something that I'm also super, super proud of. Please look forward to that because the team is still working very, very hard on that.
I didn't play I'm a Fish, but I watched some videos. It looks like a lot of fun.
Yes.
I tried it.
Like people ask,
is it only on Steam?
On Steam and Xbox.
Okay. Ah, nice.
Yeah. We were in the Game Pass for a long time. It was Game Pass day one. And people were telling us, this is made in Unreal, isn't it? And we were like, no, this is Unity. And people were blown away. Like we had 1.5 years to make this game. And it was not always easy, but I had a very, very smart and lovable team at hand, and that I still hold very dear to my heart. And we did something great and we knew it. And it looks like a Pixar movie. And every time someone was like, it feels like a Pixar movie, plays like I Am Brad. We're like, yeah, we should have made it easier.
how big was it team? Like, how many people do you need to make a game like this?
So we were, including freelancers and external partners, roughly 40 people at peak.
Okay.
We could have had the lower team size if we would have had more time, but we only had 1.5 years. So that triangle, you know, money, time, and quality, you can have it all. We wanted quality, we wanted time. So we had to put more money into getting additional people on board. But we were quite selective with the people that we brought on board. We only worked with freelancers that we already knew. Also because of the time constraints, we didn't want people that came in completely new and didn't know how we were working. And that helped us quite a lot to reach that mark. So yeah, I Am Fish is a story of its own. Like that I can fill a whole podcast episode with that. But I can just recommend that it was one of my personal
Whose idea was it to make a game about a fish?
It was my lead designer and very good friend of mine, Luke Williams, who's still working at Bossa and still is now the lead designer on Lost Skies, was working on it as part of a game jam with Reese Benbury as the only developer. And they made that game jam game, which was like like props from the Unity Asset Store and just well put together. But their initial idea was like, what if you would play a Super Monkey Ball, but you don't control the ball, but you control the monkey? And it's like, okay, interesting. And then they did it. So there's a lot of physics involved. You were the fish. You're not controlling the fish bowl. You're controlling the fish in the bowl, which leads to, with physics in mind, to some very tense situations where the ball is rolling in one direction. You have too much momentum and you cannot push enough with the fish against it to change direction or something like that. So you have to be very mindful how you steer your fish and how you steer your bowl. So it was their idea. And like, we just took over from conception, from the point of conception. We were like, okay, how can we make this even more fun and more pretty? So we introduced new vehicles like a bucket or like a jar, or spoilers, the stomach of a drunk guy. So we had a lot of fun coming up with these ideas. We wanted to make also different fish, so we have 4 fish in total, like with different abilities. We had so many more ideas for more fish and DLC, but unfortunately, Iron Fish was not as successful financially as we were hoping for.
Yeah.
We broke even, but for making more, it was not enough.
That's the thing. I mean, it's such a competitive marketplace.
Yeah.
And it's becoming even more competitive now. Though so many games are coming out and, you know, it's difficult.
It is
difficult to make a game that a lot of people will play. I think I was reading an article today about Suicide Squad, and yeah, like they're not very happy with the sales as well. I mean, they're saying they having kind of a similar amount of sales that Hogwarts Legacy had at the same time when they released it, Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean,
The market is quite saturated right now. That's definitely a problem. And people point towards indie games like Lethal Company or Vampire Survivor. They have like immense spikes and sell a lot with little to no effort. Now, that's not true. With little to no marketing effort, I would say. Mm-hmm. But like just go viral. But those are like exceptions. And I'm very, very happy for the people that make those games because they deserve it. I played Lethal Company. I play a lot of Vampire Survivors. I love them. But I think as an industry, we're at a point in time where we see that with all the layoffs, we have to reconsider our processes mm-hmm. and we have to become more, not streamlined. I think we have to be more efficient. Games these days, especially AAA games, and that's my humble opinion, cost a lot of money because not studios are bloated, but studios don't have efficient processes that allow them to develop games in quality and time. In a bearable budget. Like Spider-Man 2 was like roughly $200 million or something like that. It's a lot of money. Like an old woman has to make a lot of like scarves for that money. Like that's really translates bad into English from a German proverb, but
it's okay. Yeah,
you get the idea.
I get it, yeah.
And I think, yeah, like our processes are just like people should in AAA, AA, and so on, and console should look more into how mobile does it. Mobile is very efficient in regards to their processes and very mindful with their spendings. And I think that's why these, it's not just the gacha mechanics and like the predatory monetization and stuff like that, but they're also sustainable for process and efficiency reasons. They spend their money wisely. Not saying that all AAA studios, by the way, are like spending their money like there was not more.
I feel like they also pivot a lot, no? Like they start with one idea, and then they move into the next one, and then the next one.
Yeah.
Not everyone, but like there's a lot of that happening as well.
Yeah, true. But you could avoid that also with like a more efficient process, I would say. I'm dying on that hill. Like at Bossa, and I think it's a bad example because it's an indie studio that the risks and money and like the budgets are lower, but we were also very game gen driven and we had something I would call like decentralized creativity. We didn't have some people that were sitting in an ivory tower and saying like, this is the next game.
Yeah.
We were collectively deciding what's good. And we obviously discussed this with our like stakeholders and CEO and was like, do you believe in this idea as well? And when they did, we went for it. And that already led to everyone being super passionate and involved and have a shared feeling of ownership. We have our industry, without disrespect, has grown very old. We have a lot of senior and principal talent that have been working on games that have like that are like already 20, 30 years ago. Like, that's not a rare thing to have people with over 25 years of experience in a studio right now. But the market has changed. The audiences have changed. Like, a game that was working 5 years ago might not be performing today anymore. And we are obsessed with bringing in senior talent into existing teams to save the game or fix it, rather than looking into young talent, people that are coming from uni, junior talent that come in closer to the newer markets that are emerging and bring have also valuable ideas. And I think that's the problem that we're experiencing right now in the games industry is very multifaceted. Mm-hmm. And that's just one of them. But I think that's something that is potentially easy to fix, because you could just like say, like, get more young people in, listen to more young people, like embrace newer markets, and don't be so strict with your direction in regards to what games does your studio do, because they might not be working anymore. And you might have already saturated the market with the one game that you do over and over and over. Like, Suicide Squad is not a bad game, but it feels like a lot of other games. And that's the problem right now. Why would I play Suicide Squad if I can play a game that feels the same, if not better, that is already in discount in Steam? And that is a question that we have to ask ourselves, as not just as AAA studios, but as an industry as a whole. Like, what kinds of experiences do we want to deliver for newer audiences? I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. No, it's a good way of looking at it. I totally agree. I mean, it feels like for a lot of young people, the barrier to entry now is so much higher. There's so much competition. And as you say, you know, studios look for more senior talent or people that have exact amount of skills, or like, you know, just certain skills. Yeah. Without kind of considering a different skill set, or without considering the personality that the person can bring in, or
exactly,
like, you know, how much more willing is one to learn new skills, or much more willing to, I don't know, put more effort into. Yeah.
There's this famous Simon Sinek quote, like, hire for attitude, not for skill. You can always teach skill, but not attitude. I'm pretty sure I butchered that, but it's exactly like that. Like, bring more people in that have the attitude, that have the passion, and that want to change something, rather than surrounding yourself with senior talent that already believes they know exactly how to do things.
Yeah. When you allocate the budget for the game as a producer, how do you typically do it? Like, what's the percentage that goes to marketing? Or does it depend? Like, what is the percentage that goes to the dev team? And is it like your job do that?
Yeah. That's not really my job. That's more like a job that I see with a like development director or CEO. Okay. I usually, like, my budget responsibility is more on a project level.
Okay.
Usually. And it's something that if you are interested in becoming a producer, you have to feel comfortable with. And I had to get comfortable with, like, over the course of the time as well. Especially if you're dealing with budgets that is going in the millions, and you're like, this is more than my whole family ever owned for generations.
And you're allowed to spend it like that for the center.
Yeah. Oh, we need that freelancer. Gonna allocate $250K for that.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh my God. It can make you feel very, very weird. But that's something I got told from my mentor in, like, when I was like a very young project manager at Vodafone. He was like, and I will always, these words will always ring in my ear. It was like, think of it as Monopoly money. No one of us will ever earn that amount of money. So just cut some zeros and just play with it, because otherwise you go insane. It was a very good advice, because if you see the monetary value in it, like, it can be very it does something with you, because you look at your salary and look at the budget that you're dealing with on an everyday basis. But to answer your question, like, I usually have the budget for the project, and in the past I had the opportunity and the privilege then to allocate it based on how I saw it fit in regards to externals, in regards to potential new hires. Obviously not without the thumbs up of my line manager, my executive producer, or my CEO. And when I was looking into freelancers, I always also consult the lead or the director of the respective discipline. Mm-hmm. Usually I'm not the one that's coming like to the art director. It's like, you need another 3D artist. Usually it's the other way around. I see production as the voice of reason in the room, where, like, have to ask, do you really need them? And then sit together, like, not because you are sitting like a dragon on the treasure, but if you give...
That's another German reference, dragon on the treasure.
Ah, damn.
That's a good one.
but because you want them to take deliberate and informed decisions. If you give a child 500 euros and send them to the candy store because they wanted candy, they will spend those 500 euros. If they come to you and they're like, I want to spend money on candy. And you're like, how much candy can you eat? Do you really need that much candy? Let me take a look at your teeth. It's like, okay, you get 10 euros for candy. The kid will still be happy.
Yeah.
But it's a different approach. It's not patronizing, but it's just like coming from a place where you try and make them think about what they actually need, because you want to make sure that you can see the end of the project with the budget that you have available. And having that constructive and very transparent dialogue is super helpful. And the past, what helped me to like keep track of budget and make actually deliver projects and budget is being very honest and transparent with my team. If someone was coming to me, it's like, I need another artist, I need another designer. I'm not saying no per se. Like I heard that phrase also, that like a good producer says no immediately. And if they come back, then you say maybe, and then let them ask three times and stuff like that. It's like, this is horrible. No, I don't say no. It's like, let's have a meeting. Let's talk about that. Let me see why you say you need that. I want to understand where you're coming from. And maybe we can find another solution that is helping us maybe to keep that budget for something that might be more urgent that we might not be able to foresee right now. Production is 50% astrology in any case. It's like nice reference to my game again. but yeah, like I always say, it's like it's 50% astrology, 50% experience. You have to develop a gut feeling of where the project is going roughly. A plan at the end of the day is nothing but an idea. So something that you have to iterate constantly. And therefore, it's better to be a little bit more conservative with your budget, but honest with your team.
Yeah. As a producer, what separates sort of a good producer from a great producer? You know, when you look at like artists, for example, right, you can look at their work and, you know, like this work looks amazing. This looks kind of average. This is just doesn't look good at all. Or for example, if you have engineers, like you can, I guess, see like some engineers are able to, you know, fix problems or find solutions to difficult problems. Some are not able to, or some are really good at one language, or some ones are not. Like what separates producers from like good ones to great ones? Is it communication? Is it like, I don't know, being able to tell the future? I don't know.
If you want an answer from a relatively decent producer, like what I tell my mentees usually when they ask me the same questions, like how can I become a good producer? It's like first of all, for me, there are different kinds of producers. You have to find your way. You have to find your style that works for you. There are producers that don't want to talk with people, that just want to crunch numbers, and that is fine. I'm not that kind of producer, and that's why when I do mentoring, I basically, it's part of my disclaimer. It's like, if you get mentorship from me, I will push you in that direction because that's the direction I believe in. If you want to be a KPI producer, then I'm not the right person for you. So just as a disclaimer for what I'm about to tell you, because like there are different kinds.
Sure.
But for me, what makes a great producer is someone that is, first of all, interested in the media. Like you cannot be a games producer without consuming games. It sounds so simple, but it's very, very important, because I see myself not just as someone that makes nice spreadsheets and pretty presentations, but I also want to be able to give my team ideas and inspiration. If an artist is coming to me and it's like, I have that idea for UI, I want to be the person that says, please check this and this reference game if you don't know them already, because maybe that will be inspiring. I think you're thinking in that kind of direction. I think that helps quite a lot, because you are, as a producer, as a good and great producer, the glue between disciplines. You are the one that enables communication. You are the one that provides transparency and information. You also, and that's something that I also usually tell people, is what does a producer produce? A producer produces culture. Like we are the ones that are brought into a team to create not just processes, but a culture that encourages shared ownership, passion, excitement for milestones rather than dread, gives direction and support where needed. You are the shield in front of the team when they need to work, like just get their work done, and don't like you keep distractions from them. But at the same time, you're also the support, like pushing them from the bottom with their like down. And that can mean sometimes that you're bringing sweets or something like that to work just to give them that sugar boost that they might need. There are many ways to do that, but being aware of your team, creating that culture, being empathic is very, very important, in my opinion. You don't want people to come with problems to you when it's already too late. You want to see these problems when they emerge. Mm-hmm. And because it's our job to solve problems. My last executive producer told me, our ultimate goal as producers is to make ourselves redundant. If everything goes well, if everything flows, then we did our good job. The problem is, our job is also to solve problems. If people don't have problems, they will make new ones. That's just in our nature.
Yeah.
They just get more abstract and more weird. Also, like, it's something that I scratched like a little bit ago. Like I said, like we create processes, but we should create processes that serve people. Like never the other way around. Like, good and a great producer, in my opinion, is able to have, they have a Batman belt of methodologies and tools and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And they look at the team, they look at the project, and none of them is alike. Never. And they know exactly, okay, this, we will start with this tool and we will iterate and develop together to create a process that is serving you to deliver the best potential outcome of this project. And you have to feel comfortable with the fact that at the end of a project, this process goes to the bin, because you cannot apply it to the next team. You cannot apply it to the next project. That can also feel a little bit dreading because it feels like you're creating something just to throw it away.
And it depends on the size of the team, on the scope, on the project, like the budget, everything.
It's super, super individual, the process that you are creating. And it's very, very important also to have shared ownership with the team, to be the enabler and not the person that comes in. It's like, we're doing Scrum now. I've seen that as well. And it's a nightmare. Like that's why a lot of people nowadays hate the word Scrum or Agile, because it has been abused a lot and people come in and say they do it, even though they have no clue on how this game is supposed to shape out or how this team is operating.
Mm-hmm.
The first question a great producer should ask their team when they're joining a new team is, how do you want to work? And you would be surprised, because people will tell you like what they want, what their expectations are from a team well run. And that's where you can start.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess it's a little bit difficult to do that when you have, I don't know, 1,000 people in a project.
It is a little bit difficult. Yeah. But usually you don't manage 1,000 people.
Yeah, right? Of course.
Like, a good size for one producer, I would say, ideally, is between 15 and 20
mm-hmm.
to manage. And that's where you can have your impact. That's where you can have like the culture and the rituals that you want to establish. And there will be some that will be given to you by the overarching structure. But in a good company that cares about their people and cares about their culture, they will also give you enough leeway to have that, bring yourself in and optimize it and individualize it for the team that you are working with.
And if your team is being run properly and, you know, you guys are able to, I don't know, reach your milestones and enjoy your free time, and at the same company you have another team that's like crunching, I don't know, they're not able to hold the producer and perhaps is not able to allocate their time properly, like does something happen then? Like, what's the relationship between those two teams? I don't know, let's say you have two teams run by two separate producers working on the same project.
I mean, it differs from studio to studio, right? And like, especially because a lot of studios also have different interpretations of what the responsibilities of a producer are.
Yeah.
Like I said, this is my interpretation of how I'm working and how I mentor others to see the production discipline. We have a hard time attracting talent, like getting people into production, because we still have to deal with that stigma of being the ones with the whip. That's no longer true. That's very old school management. We don't do that anymore nowadays. But to answer your question, what usually happens like in these kind of scenarios, we are no strangers to each other. Like, especially if you work in the same company, producers talk with each other, believe it or not. And we want to support each other. Just because we know we are a rare discipline that has to deal with a lot of problems on a daily basis, and it can be very taxing and demanding. So in the best case scenario, this would never happen because there is communication up front,
sure,
and there's exchange and there's support. Where like if I run a team that is not working optimal and I have problems, I would come to another producer whose team might be running like super smoothly, or who has been working with my team before and was like, okay, I have this issue. Can you help me with that? And most of the time that person will say, yes, let's talk about that. And I will give you some hints and pointers how you can fix that. It's very helpful to have like this kind of network within a company of different producers, have a production team. If the worst case scenario happens where something goes very much south, it's also very important to have that support from other producers so you can come together and like do some sparring and understand what just happened and how to fix it together. Like, you don't let producers and their teams to die like because it was not working out. And there have been situations like that in my past as well, where I saw like a team not performing that was not mine. But then it's like I said, it's like before, a great skill to have empathy and seeing these kind of things early, approaching the producer then that has these kind of problems and not wait for them to come to you to help them help themselves. Basically.
Sure. What are the most common conflicts that arise in teams, and how do you mitigate those?
Oh boy, that's a big one. So the most common conflicts in games, and especially because when we're working on games, we talk about working with like a spectrum of different disciplines, and these disciplines usually don't talk the same language.
Sure.
I'm not talking one speaks Polish, one speaks English. It's like just having different vocabulary already like makes it harder and basically gives me a job because I'm the one trying to translate that, most of the time succeeding. Most of the conflicts come from misunderstandings and miscommunication, which is funny because like we never have been better connected and never had more options to actually communicate with each other. Like every studio has some sort of Jira or like task tracking tool, some sort of Confluence and some sort of Slack, but still miscommunication happens all the time because we might mean the same thing, but we talk in different aspects about it. And that's usually where conflicts are. That's the easy one to resolve though, because that's usually like, okay, I have no understanding what artists want, what design wants.
Yeah.
I can communicate between them and we can solve this. One that is also relatively common, but can be solved most of the time easy as well, is like when it's not very clear if your game design, like if the game development process is either design driven, art driven, tech driven. It's like, who's owning the game? Like, who's the main stakeholder of the game's vision? If that is not clarified at the beginning of a game, you get a lot of conflict because everyone wants to have a saying, everyone wants to push their agenda. Art wants it, makes it super beautiful. Design wants it, make it super like challenging and design heavy. Tech wants it to be a masterpiece in regards to code. You can just solve this. This is also relatively easy to solve if you just like have an early meeting in the process where you define ownership and who's driving it. And most companies basically nowadays say, like, we are a design-driven studio, we are a tech-driven studio, so you already know where you're coming from.
It's kind of part of their culture, no?
It's part of the culture, exactly. So if that is not well-defined, you get a lot of conflict as well because people will fight for ownership. Not with bad intent, but just because they don't know better, because it has never been spoken out. And you need one owner of the vision. It's unfortunately like that. You can pay into a vision, but it's better to have one person that is driving the vision than three people like fighting for like ownership.
Is it usually a creative director or an executive producer, or does it depend?
That depends from studio to studio. I've seen both. Most common is actually like, for me, the most common thing I've seen so far is like it being design driven, and free to play is usually more product driven, where it's like, okay, like I said, like producers and free to play are usually also more KPI focused. Again, it's nothing bad. But games are usually more product driven, where you look at like the long-term strategy of a product, the KPI development of the product, and take design decisions and art decisions based on performance of the KPIs. So yeah, depends. not the best answer, I fear.
No, but it's good. I thought I was going to get some kind of juicy answers, or I don't know, some examples of people beating each other up.
I have seen that as well. If you want to hear these kind of stories. those are not the common ones, I can say. I don't want to scare anyone away from the games industry. Yeah. Like, these are the very, very, very rare cases where conflicts go into yelling or like some sort of abusive behavior.
But I guess it's sometimes also the reason that happens is not even the fault of the people that are in the conflict.
Yep.
Right? Sometimes it's just the situation that might be frustrating, and that could be someone else's fault.
Yeah, and that's funny enough, I see that also as part of the responsibility of the producer to spot and detangle. Again, empathy is super important. I always want to believe if someone has a problem or someone is not performing, that they want to do their best job. If someone cannot do their best job, there's a reason, and I want to know this reason. And you would be surprised how many times just a simple conversation can uncover these reasons. And it can be that someone is very frustrating and yelled in a meeting because their hamster died yesterday, and their hamster was very dear to them. And like next day, they are like as happy as always.
Yeah.
But if you don't dig into that, if you don't connect with that person and you are not willed to understand why they're like that, their career in that company might be spoiled by that one meeting where they had a bad time because their hamster died. And that's not fair. So like I said, it's always very important for me to approach people with, you want to do your best job, you are not doing it right now, I want to know why. And in that understanding, you will do yourself and your team a favor, and that person as well.
How do you avoid crunch in the game development process?
Oh my God, do you want me to solve all of these things right now? It's tricky because I've been in crunch as well, like over the course of my career, and it's not fun. Like, no one likes it.
Is it common? Is it more common than uncommon?
It's like, I would say it was more common. It gets less common these days because people start to understand that it has, not start to understand, but I think people have understood that it has a very negative impact on mental, physical health and long-term retention of like talent. And you want to keep your team healthy because these are your most valuable resources when making games. Without them, there is no game. You try to put like 4 CEOs in a room and let them make a game. I want to see that. You have to take care of the people that actually do the job on a daily basis. And I think we have built this understanding. But to avoid crunch, I think that lies a lot of the responsibility. Like most of the time, it lies in the responsibility of producers because we do the planning. I mentioned before, it's 50% strategy, 50% experience. But to avoid crunch, in my opinion, we have to think as a discipline in regards to planning more iteratively. And that hasn't happened in the past. Always. I saw that also in projects where I was crunching, where crunch was mainly coming from dictated roadmaps, where there was no room for iteration. And like I said before, plans are ideas. And that's it. They are not some cosmic construct that we have to align with, otherwise we are in deep trouble. It's something that changes over time with the world, like with our industry. A lot of plans have changed during COVID, hopefully. Some might have not, but they would have most likely also faced like the consequences of that. You have to approach your plan iteratively. What I mean with that is like frequently check against your targets, work with ranges rather than with fixed dates. If I tell you today, my game is coming out, we talked about that. My board game is coming out on the 21st of November. I don't even know right now what I'm going to eat next week. So how can I tell you with confidence it's going to come out in November 21st? What I can do is always like, I can tell you I have the confidence that it's going to deliver in November.
Sure.
And then the closer we get to the date, I will be like, it will be the second week of November. And the closer we get to that date, like I will be able to tell you it's going to be the 15th of November. I'm super sure. And then the day before, I can tell you it's going to come out on the 15th of November at 4:00. But that has to be that is basically what I think is the best approach to avoid crunch, to have that leeway, to have that ongoing conversation with your stakeholders, with your team, with getting that input from both sides and marrying it in the plan constantly, and not just making a perfect master plan that's used for 3 years of development. You're like, this is it. This game is coming out exactly on that date.
because then you will work towards that date without like full vision of all the problems that might come across your place, across you. And where do you bring that confidence from? Like, where do you get that confidence from that date from? It's just because you did the math, but it's not like considering real life events and talent turnover and all that kind of stuff. You can put that into a buffer, but even that will be gone in no time. So yeah, long story short, I think to avoid crunch, you just have to approach roadmaps nowadays with a way more iterative mindset and be very transparent with your team. Listen to your team, listen to your stakeholders as well, because they also have their own expectations and agendas on why they want to have something in a certain place. Just be honest, give ranges, work towards those ranges and iterate constantly.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, if you're a company and you announce that your game is coming out, let's say in a year on the exact date and exact time, you kind of put a target on your team that they have to deliver it now.
Exactly.
And if they don't, then there's going to be issues. And obviously the games can be delayed, and there's been a lot of delays, I know, last year and the year before for different reasons.
I love what Capcom actually did when they were like presenting the roadmap for their Monster Hunters, like the Live Ops roadmaps.
Mm-hmm.
And I use it usually as a very good example of how I think community communicated roadmap should look like. They were like, you will get the first content patch in spring.
Right.
And it's like, it doesn't put a target in
your team. Or Q2 or Q3 or whatever it is.
But they just said spring. And then there will be another one in summer and another one in autumn. And people are like, and the closer they were getting to that date, they were like, oh, actually, it's going to be February. And people were like, oh my God, it's going to be February. And people were happy with that. And then they were like, actually, it's going to be February on that date. Like, you give yourself, also from a marketing perspective, you give people something to look forward to and get excited about and get more detail about, way more room to play with your community. But you don't put that target on your players, of your team. You're not like, I told the community yesterday it's going to be 31st of February. So I don't care about like if there's a game breaking bug. You put in the extra hours.
Come here on Saturday and Sunday. Make sure it's delivered.
And players don't need it that much ahead of time. That's the thing. Like, especially with the amount of games that we have nowadays, I barely can track the games that come out on a daily basis. And not to speak about the ones that I'm actually excited about, I'm surprised when they're there these days, where I'm like, I'm happy to buy them, play them then. But there's so many games that, I understand from the marketing perspective that you want to build this hype and so on. You want to build the community around it, but you can do that with more vague dates and ranges rather than with exact dates to be respectful with the team that is actually developing it, because you never know what's going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, the more recent example I remember from Embark Studios.
Mm.
I don't know if you played the finals.
So yes, I did, actually quite a lot.
All right. Well, I mean, and there you go. With them as well, I don't think they had an actual release date a few weeks before they released it.
And it was just there and people were excited. And like, right. I immediately downloaded it.
And they're doing the same thing with the next game, with Arc Raiders.
Yeah.
Like, they're saying it should be coming out,
and that's great,
sometime soon, but like they haven't.
And the closer they will get to it, they will get also like a rough time frame. At some point, they will say, oh, it's going to be Q1 2025.
Yeah.
And then people can get excited about that without putting, like you mentioned it before, the target on the dev team. And I think that is actually a very healthy way to avoid crunch, but still give marketing enough material to work towards their goals.
Yeah. To maybe finish it off. So if I'm a student and I know, let's say aesthetic game design or whatever it is, gaming-related discipline, and my goal is to become a game producer, how do I enter the industry? Like, what's the most common nowadays? Is it going through QA? Is it, I don't know, jumping straight into a production role? Like, what's the, you know, like, how'd you do it? Like, was the process? How would you do it nowadays?
So first, I can tell you don't have to be a butcher before you enter.
Yeah.
Like, that's not mandatory. There are different paths into production. I think QA is one of the most common ones because I would say it's a good one because it allows you to experience all the disciplines and work with the tools that your production works on a day-to-day basis. QA is, for me, one of my most valued like disciplines in like just game development in general, because they are at the heartbeat of the game. And if I want to know if the product is healthy, I need them. I don't have the resources to do that on a daily basis, but they will tell me if it's not good. So I can take informed decisions. And that already implies that you will work also close with production if you're in QA. So it's a very valid entry. If you don't want to go to QA because, I don't know, like you have a traumatic experience with testing games, another valid entrance is like coming from the more managing side of things. I would always recommend to start building that Batman toolbar that I mentioned before. Be curious about methodologies. Be curious about tools. There's more than Jira. There's also more than Scrum. There are a lot of very good books out there and a lot of very good communities that support producers. I think I mentioned like we are a very rare breed. Not a lot of people want to go into production. So that's another way to enter. Find a mentor. Like there are a lot of producers out there that are more than happy to share what they have and teach you the ropes on how to get into production. Just ask them on LinkedIn, because we know what we have from new producers coming to the industry, because there are more people dropping out of production than people are dropping in. Don't quote me on that. I don't have numbers for that, but I know how many colleagues I lost already over the course of the years during my career who were like,
right,
actually, I would rather be working in fintech. Actually, I would rather be QA technician again. I actually heard that.
Is it because it's stressful, or is it because...
It is quite stressful.
Gaming industry, being a producer in the gaming industry specifically, yeah. Right?
I don't want to spoil it for anyone who is curious about production, because I still love this, my job, but it's demanding physically and mentally. It's not just making pretty spreadsheets, but everything, if all the things that I mentioned before, like talking with people can be exhausting, dealing with problems can be exhausting, and you are usually the one that is expected to solve all of this and who's going to help the problem solver. There's usually not many people that help you besides other producers, and you have to be up for that. You also deal with the chaos. Like, game development is chaos. It's pure chaos. And it was the head of development at Sharkmob, head of production at Sharkmob, who told me, like, there are only two breeds of producers, in her opinion. The ones that see the chaos and feel the urge to sort it, and the ones that see it and succumb to it. So you have to be the first to really succeed in production. You have to feel the need to sort things and make sure that people can work and people can talk with each other. And that can be very demanding. One of my production mentor actually told me, if you want to go into production, you have to feel comfortable with always being the dick. If things go right, you will be the dick. If things go wrong, you will be the dick. And it's like, if you can live with that, welcome to production. And it's so right. At that time, I didn't really understand what he meant, but it's like, if your team is performing great, if you do have a huge success, you're the one to take a step back and give the credit to the team, where it belongs. You're not the one standing in front of them. It's like, it was all me. You're the one that's standing behind. It was all them.
Yeah.
But if things go bad, you're not the one that stands behind them and says, it was all them. You stand in front of them. You're like, it was all me. I take the full responsibility.
It's like being a manager at a sports team.
Yeah, like coach. It requires some sort, like it requires leadership skills to a certain degree, because you have to feel comfortable with that. You have to feel comfortable with taking responsibility where it's demanded and giving credit where it's due. And if that is something that you are curious about, then welcome to production.
Cool. Welcome to production. Right. Nice. Look, really nice to talk to you. Appreciate you coming over.
Yeah. Thank you for inviting me. It was a lot of fun.
Maybe we can do this again sometime in the future. Talk about other things. Maybe.
Anytime.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, man.
Thank you.